Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. 2024 marks 100 years since a watershed moment in Russia's history. The death of Vladimir Lenin and the beginning of Joseph Stalin's rise to power. In this episode, Professor John Russell deep dives into the complexities of Russia's past and present, from Stalin's rise to power to Putin's fifth presidential term. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, this episode takes a broad sweep at Russia's last century, asking to what extent the current situation builds on the Soviet legacy left by Lenin, Stalin, and their successors.
I'm using Russia to cover the Soviet Union too. In this country, happened to be the most popular leaders amongst the Russian people. And those of you who were at the recent talk I gave on this will know why, because each person tends to pick a great winner as their hero or heroine. And as far as the Russian people are concerned, beating Hitler in World War II, albeit at the cost of 28 million Soviets, and I want to stress they were Soviets, so they were Russians, Ukrainians, Jews, Georgians, Muslim Tartars. But that loss, I've argued many times, enables us to be here today. And I think that is worth reminding the British people. I was brought up just after the war, when there were still bomb sites all over London, where I was born. And I do remember Uncle Joe being referred to in very, very friendly terms, by the population thereabouts. That's all gone. And if you think about Biden comparing Putin with Hitler at the D-Day landings, It's not so much that, it's political rhetoric. It's more the deep, deep insult that Russian people felt when he said that. Of course, Putin was not invited to the D-Day landings. If you wanted something, recently was on BBC about Stalin, Roosevelt and Churchill. And there's a very, very good series of about six programs that cover the good, the bad, and the ugly, I think you can say. All of them had their moments, and I think the bottom line was that at the time it was an absolutely crucial alliance. As you would expect from me, I've done some research this morning because this is a changing goalpost, if you like, and I'm slightly worried. I read three things this morning that did concern me. The Spectator had an article by Mark Galliotti saying that he didn't think that it was a good thing for the Western security services to assassinate Putin. And I thought, my goodness, if you want World War III, that's an open invitation. At the same time, The Economist had an editorial saying that get Ukraine into NATO before Trump takes over. If you want World War III, that's another open invitation. But more worrying was a publication called The Hill from Washington, in which two writers, a very influential journal, in which two writers said, World War III has already begun. What about the USA starts winning it? And its recipe for winning it was to arm Ukraine to the teeth and arm Israel to the teeth so that in one blow you could get rid of Putin's Russia, Hamas, but also Hezbollah and also Iran. If you want World War III, go ahead. So it's frightening. The dialogue at the moment is beginning to ratchet up, and I'm old enough to remember the from my older brothers and sisters and parents, the ratcheting up before World War II. If we're not careful, if there's not a counter dialogue, then we are on a very slippery road. Two things really prompted me to do this talk about Russia 100, from Lenin, Stalin to Putin. I think you could have a sort of joke amongst yourself and write little balloons what they're thinking about each other in that picture on the left. And the picture on the right, I've again chosen, it's the same picture of Putin, because he's got the flag of Russia next door to him. And what I want to point out here is on the flag is the patron saint of Russia, who is none other than St. George. Now, before we all scream, hang on, he's English, remember that he probably came from Armenia or present-day Turkey, but it is interesting to know that we share a patron saint. So 100 years ago today, Lenin died, and pretty soon afterwards, Labour had its first government ever in this country. So it's very fitting in Bradford, where the British Labour Party was founded, to actually speak to you days, literally days after a Labour government has come in. As a result of the first Labour government, the Conservative government they replaced lived through the Red Scare after the Russian Revolution, and really didn't want any relations with Soviet Russia at all. Labour did, and not only Labour, but a group of left-wing intellectuals, I suppose. I think the Daily Mail would nowadays call them woke intellectuals, really wanted to get to know. They were curious. They were people of the from literary circles like E.M. Forster, H.G. Wells, Virginia Woolf, but also scientists like Haldane and Julian Huxley, not Aldous Huxley, but his brother Julian, and philosophers like Bertrand Russell, no relation, and actress Sybil Thorndike. So a very powerful group of people got together in London, actually next Tuesday, 100 years ago next Tuesday, and formed the Society for Cultural Relations between the British Commonwealth and Soviet Russia. The Daily Mail did a piece the next day saying, what are they up to? And from then on, pretty much this society was tarred with being useful idiots. And remember, this is Bertrand Russell, Haldane, and Julian Huxley. But nonetheless, throughout the, certainly until the end of the Second World War, it was a very thriving society. I took over that society in 1980 when I was finishing my PhD, living in Brixton in London, and the SCR was situated in Brixton. And it was a fantastic opportunity because you had not only a great library, but also unprecedented contacts with our Soviet cultural organizations and with British cultural organizations. The only problem was, since the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, there'd been a cultural boycott on any relations at all with the Soviet Union. So I had to go it alone and sort of make my own contacts against a very, very hostile environment. So that's one of the reasons that I think today is a good reason to flag up, because so many of what happened 100 years ago, I think, is reflected either in reality or potentially in the situation we live in today. The only thing missing now is that the threat is not the Red Scare, it's the Russian Scare. And so it's not so much the communists who are evil, it's the Russians who are evil. And as somebody who's lived there, studied there twice for a year, worked there, played football there, got to the Moscow Cultural Workers' Cup final by knocking out the might of Bolshoi Ballet and the TASS news agency, married a Russian, conceived a son in Moscow. He went on to marry a Russian, so my grandson is three-quarters Russian, but has a mighty left foot and desperately wants to play for England. I think many immigrants have had that situation. So, in many ways, it wants to be, you know, Vladimir to Vladimir rather than Joseph Stalin to Vladimir. Vladimir in Russian means ruler of the world. And I think the fear in 1924, before he died, was that Lenin wanted to be ruler of the world. The fear in 2024 is that Vladimir Putin wants to be ruler of the world. Now, Vladimir also means the ruler of peace, Mir meaning peace and the world, which is an interesting linguistic point. I would argue that neither Lenin nor Putin has any real interest in being leader of the world. But I suppose what worries me, and this is where the first literary reference I'm going to make, is that Ernest Hemingway, after World War II, spoke about the discord sown by feeding the manure of schism on everything. So, you know, why can't people write, be more positive about things that unite them? Why do they always have to go to extremes and criticize each other? My second influence, I've just come back from the United States, and those of you that came to my talk last year here will know that I describe the United States as the most seductive culture in the history of mankind, but potentially the most destructive. And by that I meant that the USA is such an enigma at the moment. I remember going there. I've got three children and nine grandchildren in the United States. And incidentally, although I'm married a Russian, I am now married to an American. So I've shifted there. But in the United States, I remember walking along a canal in a small town in Maryland, and there was a 60s concert going on, and people were dancing to sort of music that I certainly remember from my teenage years, and everything looked wonderful. And yet, going back to the car park, we had to go under a bridge, and under the bridge were the drunks, the drug addicts, the homeless, the destitute. It was both sides of America. It reminded me of Fyodor Dostoevsky when he came to London. He saw Victorian society in all its pomp, but what he really noticed were the homeless under the railway tunnels in that great city. My youngest granddaughter, who's coming up 12, got fascinated by Russia. She has no connection. She's from the American side of the family. And I gave her one of those lacquered spoons. I don't know if any of you have seen them, those beautiful colored lacquered spoons that the Russians tend to give tourists. And she wrote a school project called Russia, the Beautiful and the Brutal. And it just so happened it was her birthday when I was back there, so I brought her an illustrated book of Russian fairy tales. And those of you that know it, that know about Palek, the very fine varnish painted boxes, will know that there's some quite beautiful art there. Unfortunately, most Russian folk tales, like a lot of German and other countries' folk tales, are pretty brutal. You know, there's Baba Yaga, the wicked stepmother, and there's plenty of chopping of heads and boiling of people alive. So I thought the beautiful and the brutal is actually a second theme that I'd like to go through today, because I think we've been absolutely battered by how brutal life in Russia is and how brutal the Russian system is. And somehow it's escaped us how beautiful some of the products of Russian society have been, particularly when they banned the Bolshoi Ballet from coming this year. It did remind me of that bad old times in the 19 80s when nothing could come in and nothing could go out. Just as a heads up, I've always found that people from the cultural world get on much, much better with Russians from the cultural world than politicians from Britain get on with politicians from Russia. And I suspect that's true of many countries. And when I say Britain, I particularly include Scotland, Wales, and Ireland, the northern bit, certainly, but I've also taken groups from Southern Ireland. And they get on much, much better than any politician in recent times has. Of course, the politician we liked in this country was Gorbachev. He is the least popular leader the Russians have ever had. Again, obvious reasons, but I think we have to take that on board. It's not that we are right and they are wrong, we are good and they are evil. If life was that simple, then I think we would certainly be a little different. So here's a bit of beautiful and brutal all in one go, because Alexander Blok is a poet who every Russian could quote. And this is his Thucydides, which he wrote in 1918. He starved to death in a garret in 1921 because everybody forgot that poets need feeding. And it's worth reading out because Russians love their poetry read out. I remember going to a Robert Graves lecture in London and asking him, did he prefer his poetry to be read or listened to? And he said, you young poets, I wasn't a poet, but he said, you young poets, that's all you think about. I just write poetry. What people do with it is up to them. But the Russians love to speak and listen to their poetry. So I'll read this little bit out. It's really addressed to what the Russians see as the last dying days of Western civilization. So again, it's very appropriate today where there is this concern that liberal democracy is on its last legs. Not concerned just from Russia, but generally from the southern hemisphere. So, O ancient world, before your culture dies, whilst failing life within you breathes and sinks, pause and be wise, as Oedipus was wise, and solve the age-old riddle of the Sphinx. That Sphinx is Russia, grieving and exulting and weeping black and bloody tears enough. She stares at you, adoring and insulting, with love that turns to hate and hate to love. And that, to me, sums out the way the Russians look at the West. Please be friends with us, but if you're not, ooh, it's going to hurt. And I think it's worth bearing in mind. If you look at Russian poets, and I think it was Yevgeny Yevtushenko who said that tyrants in Russia fear poets most of all, because poets tell it like it is. And there's something about Russians, which is why, you know, you'll obviously get a bias from me because I am a Russophile. I love their poetry, I love their theatre, I love their music, I love their people. In a way, maybe that Steve Rosenberg, the BBC correspondent, does. He had a very similar pattern to me, except he was in Russia, I was in the Soviet Union, fell in love with a beautiful young Russian, married, and the only way then, really, to make a life was to work as a translator in Moscow, which he did. And differences, he's still there. I came home. If you look at the Russian poets, Sergei Yesenin, who wrote his last poem in his blood after he cut his wrists. Goodbye, dear friend, goodbye. And, you know, it's what a Russian way to die. Vladimir Mayakovsky, who wrote the poem marking the death of Lenin and read it out in a factory, and grown working men cried. And I've seen grown Russian men cry Boris Mozhaev, a huge Russian with a huge beard. I took him to Larne to see Dylan Thomas's grave near Swansea. And he cried. He just cried. What a tragedy that we lost such a great poet. Then I took him to Cambridge, and we went to one of the oldest libraries in Cambridge, and he cried again. And he said, we don't have a single library like this in the whole of Russia, because we've had so many wars, and you've got about 10 in Cambridge. How lucky you are. And again, it was, sometimes you need a voice from afar. It's a bit like there's been a lot of talk about how decent the transfer of power between Sunak and Starmer was. Sunak paid tribute to Starmer, Starmer paid tribute to Sunak. How many countries of the world is that going to happen? Not in the United States, for sure. And we shall see at this moment what's going to happen in France. Again, sometimes you need somebody from the outside to tell you how lucky you are, because we still have that and should hang on to it. There were women poets too, Marina Tsvetaeva, who hung herself rather than working for the secret police in 1941. Her most famous poet was probably called Tuska pa Rodine, which is nostalgia. And again, this is something that Russians have. They do feel like fish out of water when they are cut off from their homeland. Anna Akhmatova, who suffered a former husband, lost in the purges, a son who was imprisoned in the purges, and a lover who was executed in the purges. A very typical fate. And Yevtushenko, who I mentioned first, he kept his nose clean, and a lot of his compatriots abroad said that he was a party man. But nonetheless, those of you that know his poem, Babi Yar, I mean, it's one of the most powerful poems about the war. Nad Babim Yarom Pamyetom Nyet. There is no monument at Babi Yar, which is where the great execution of Russian Jews happened in World War II. So Russian poetry really, it's almost like they're rock stars. They really are. And I say rock stars because, in a way, we still have poetry. And I don't really, you know, I'm not disparaging Simon Armitage, but I mean, the real poets probably of our time are more likely to be Leonard Cohen and Bob Dylan Paul Simon. You know, that's the kind of impact. Taylor Swift, throw one in there too for my grandkids. So, this is the brutal bit. You know, one can't get away from the Ukraine war. I said last year I thought it was a grave mistake for Putin to go in. It will be very, very difficult for him to reconcile what for centuries was a very close relationship between the Ukrainians, or should I say most of the Ukrainians, and Russians. But I do want to emphasize this this Z, because there is no Z in the Russian alphabet. And Z has become the symbol of the Russian special military operation, which they call it. We call it the unprovoked and full-scale invasion. Now, trust me, as a professor emeritus, albeit of Russian and security studies, although it was wrong-headed and although it was brutal and though we should condemn it, the Russian invasion was not full-scale and it was not unprovoked. Clearly, I'm not by no means alone in saying that. I don't always like to be on the same side of an argument as Nigel Farage, but what wasn't, or I missed it, what wasn't printed in the British press was that Donald Trump agreed with him. He came out and endorsed what Nigel Farage had said. It was totally missed by the US main media and totally missed, as far as I know, correct me if I'm wrong, by the British media. I think the Z or the Z actually comes from za, but the Z in Russian is a three, so they never use it on military outfits, particularly tanks. So they've replaced it with a Z, or a Z, and the Z, particularly in the colours of the ribbon of St George, which is awarded to anybody who's ever fought for the Soviet Union or Russia. So it's the equivalent of our poppy, in a way. Think of our poppy being utilised for a military campaign. And some say the Z means Zapad, which is the West. Some say it means za Rodinu, for the motherland, and some say it means za Pobyedu. The important thing is it's been hijacked by the Russian nationalistic right and is being seen almost ubiquitously throughout Russia at the moment. One thing I would try to put across to you is that it's not a case of being pro-Russian. I would say my experience, 1966 was the first time I've been, probably been 100 times, which, as a friend of mine in the Foreign Office told me, that rules you out of a job with us for life. Plus you married a Russian and you're a member of the Lambeth Labour Party. My God, you've no chance. So getting Russia is not easy. It's not easy at all. The only two people I can think of who are regularly on the news who do is Steve Rosenberg, that I mentioned. I think he's done a grand tightrope job of keeping his job and his wife and his family is over here. But a good old Leeds graduate, so, made in Yorkshire. And Misha Glenny, who is the son of Michael Glenny, who came to fame through translating the books of Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I first met Misha Glenny when he was 9 and didn't have a beard, so he's changed a lot. But getting Russia is very difficult, and I would claim, through my years of experience, to have got Russia. And certainly, I'm not alone in that, but one of the things that I've called it nostalgia, because nost is a suffix in Russian, which is a passion, a feeling, an emotion. And so much of Russia, Russianness, is expressed in emotions. They're very emotional about what it is to be Russian. Now, being emotional means they're not particularly rational, and this can cause problems. So I've got two quotes here, one from a 19th century poet. Russia cannot be understood with a mind alone. No ordinary yardstick can span her greatness. She stands alone, unique. In Russia, one can only believe. So it's a faith. It's a faith. That's the only thing. Trouble is, what if you don't believe and you're Russian? You've got problems. You've got real problems. Tolstoy didn't believe. He had problems. Solzhenitsyn didn't believe, he had problems. And most of those poets I mentioned didn't believe. They were more rational. There's got to be more to it than just a feeling. Richard Sackler, who with Nick Baines did the talk on Russia 2 years ago at the Literature Festival, and I've slightly changed it. I'm sorry, Richard, but I couldn't get in touch with you before this. And he makes the claim that Russia, unlike European countries, is a civilization power. It doesn't think in terms of national pride. It thinks in terms of where its civilization lies in the world picture. And that's slightly different. The nearest equivalent I can think of historically is the British Empire, which, you know, certainly I grew up at the end of. And today, probably the USA, because the USA believes in its manifest destiny, they claim an exceptionalism that pretty much everybody else in the world doesn't grant them. And that's going to cause conflicts in the future. The other country I'd throw into there is China. I mean, China calls itself the Middle Kingdom. And in many ways, they see themselves as equal, not in terms of power, but equal in terms of rights and status in the world as the United States. The United States does not consider China and Russia as equals. It has in the past, as we shall see, but at the moment, the United States seems to be desperate to hold on to a unipolar world system. And I think the rest of the world realizes, a little bit like Bloch, that time has passed. Now, I did say that America was the most seductive power in the world. There is still enormous, enormous human, scientific, and production potential in the United States, far and away the most important in the world. It's society that seems to have been broken. I mean, look at the present political standoff between Biden. I was going to joke that if I lose my way halfway through this, I'll just say, well, it's a Biden moment. You know, it's become quite. And Trump, who basically is a congenital liar. I mean, anybody who stands for president who thinks the revolution of 1775, and he got the year wrong, the most important thing was when the Union forces seized the airports. I think, you know, I wouldn't particularly want him as my leader. But if 70 million Americans do, hey, who am I to say, who am I to deny them? I won't dwell on Stalin because I think it's enough to say what I've said already. He's the most popular leader because he beat Hitler in World War II. If 28 million war losses is too great to grasp, let me tell you, the city of Leningrad lost 600,000 citizens through hunger in World War II, which is more than the combined total losses of the US and UK military. That's one city. And, I visited Leningrad, as it then was, in the first time in 1967, and there were still people around who would not throw away a crust of bread. Just wouldn't. You know, it was so hard. And of course, Anna Akhmatova, who I mentioned earlier, wrote this wonderful poem, The Requiem, to celebrate the people of Leningrad. Shostakovich wrote the Leningrad Symphony, and it was one of the incredible feats, along with Stalingrad, I suppose, and the defense of Moscow, a real turning point in World War II. So, obviously, I'm not a fan of Stalin, I'm not a fan of Putin, I'm not a fan of the Russian style of government, but I understand why millions of Russians do appreciate Stalin, what he did in World War II, and how he took the country. I think, you know, my doctoral thesis was on how Stalin turned a nation of peasants into workers. And his motivation was, if we don't do it in 10 years, the West will bury us. He didn't say bury us, that was Khrushchev, but that's what he meant. And he said that in June 1931. In June 1941, Hitler did launch a full-scale invasion, and it was unprovoked. So he was right in that. And who are we? I mean, it's horrific what happened under Stalin in the Soviet Union. But if the end game was they survived, they beat Hitler, they enabled us to beat Hitler, then, you know, what price? It's a bit like England winning the European Championship, isn't it? Playing terrible football, but winning on penalties in the end anyway. It's who can deny them their view of history? It's not that. But I think that when Biden did liken Putin, who he has also said, will nobody rid me of this madman? Very, very dangerous talk in a world which looks very different from Washington to, I would argue, the rest of the world. But if anybody wants any questions on Stalin and Putin, I'll be glad to take them. Oh, I'm sorry. The six Soviet cultural icons that I thought give you an example of what I meant by the war and peace argument. Because if I said war and peace, who do you think of? Tolstoy, yeah? There is the war and peace football match between peace studies and war studies, but they've grown much, much bigger than us, and they win every year now. It wasn't always thus. This is Lenin, this is the poem that Mayakovsky wrote for Lenin, and incredible book, because if you look at it, there's hardly any colour there at all. There's one colour, because printers don't count black and white. The white turned yellow with age because it was very cheap paper, and so the only colour was red. And look what he's done, because he designed his own book covers, as well as being, he was a kind of John Lennon of his day, you know, film star, singer, actor, painter, everything. And he, of course, was part of this incredible constructivist movement, this new world of men and women, artists, poets, potters, who came out after the revolution and who devoted themselves, whatever their background, to producing things for the working people. And that book, it seems to me, he's got the hammer and sickle, he's got the rising sun, and he's got the red flag, all crammed together. I mean, a wonderful piece of work, and it cost nothing, you know, absolutely nothing to produce. And that was the poem that had grown workers in tears. Next door, those of you that have been to Moscow probably have seen the worker and the collective farm girl. The importance of this statue, it first appeared at the Paris World Exhibition of 1937. Smack in between this monument and the Eiffel Tower, the Eiffel Tower was between them, was Hitler's monument to the Third Reich. So you had the huge eagle and this very Hitler-esque architecture, and against it was the worker and the collective farm girl. Done by a woman. It was Vera Mukhina who did it. Again, she didn't have trouble with the authorities. She just had a terrible skiing accident that smashed her face and her beauty at an early age. But she did live throughout the purges. And that incredibly inspiring monument is still there in Moscow today. They wanted to take it down because it was communist propaganda. But in the end, they did the opposite. They put it back on the plinth, which it was originally on in Paris, and now it stands tall and proud. Shostakovich, you probably all know the story of his band opera. Stalin went to listen to Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk district, and the next day Pravda published, "This is chaos, not music," and Shostakovich was banned. And the price we all pay, Shostakovich actually had four operas based on heroic Russian women. I think the next one was Sofia Perovskaya, who was the woman terrorist that of the 1890s. Then it was Larissa Reisner, who was that incredible Russian woman who fought throughout the Russian Civil War for the Reds. And finally, there was the shock brigade of cement layer, the women shock brigade of cement layers at Dniprogras, ironically now in the Ukraine, and he had sketched out an opera about them. The world has lost those three operas because Shostakovich wasn't allowed to go back to them. Yuri Gagarin, those of you old enough, remember he came to Britain in 1962, and had a wonderful reception here. Somebody who was there told me it was like Tom Jones. It was, you know, the women just swooned over this handsome, handsome pilot. Bolshoi Ballet. Again, I've seen English footballers cry watching the Bolshoi Ballet in the Bolshoi Theatre. Sorry, am I running late? Okay. They have been banned, and one hopes that there will be a resolution sooner rather than later. Dr. Zhivago, What's Not to Love? If you like balalaika music, Pasternak couldn't publish it in Russia until Gorbachev came along, but it's become one of the great classics of our time. There were times when we did get Russia, Kissinger and Nixon, Reagan and Thatcher, and then Bush, Blair and Putin. So there certainly were times, but there were downsides too. And I've already mentioned the 1980 to 84, but the present one is the longest period. Okay, this is the nearest I've got to the man. I was in row 5 in 2013. And again, notice the Nosts. Don't worry about what they mean, but the essence of Putinism is three Nosts, three emotions. Russia is a great power. It's got a single strong executive with Putin at the top, and Sobornost is marching together. And it made me laugh because I was interpreter in 1999, just before Putin came to power, with Leeds United, who had two games in Moscow. And marching together, of course, was the song of Leeds then. And I think they'd quite like Vladimir Putin as a director. Don't read the whole thing. Basically, what he's saying is you can't draw lines between evil and good between countries or even institutions. The line between evil and good is in all our hearts, all our hearts. And the trouble is, who wants to cut out the evil bit of their heart? And this guy, I think, has the right to say that. He wrote a joke about Stalin, didn't even call him Stalin. He said the guy in the Kremlin with a moustache and got sentenced to hard labour, survived, got kicked out of Russia because he said, I'm a Russian writer, not a Soviet writer, went to live in the States, and eventually got so homesick that he went back. So, finally, to end on a positive note, what do you do if you negate the negative? You get a positive. One of the problems of the West saying we are good and you, Russia, China, the rest of your supporters are evil, is that a plus times a minus equals a minus. Because the other side doesn't believe that you're the force of good and we're forces of evil. I've called this the three mix because Mick Jagger, one of my favorite songs is Sympathy for the Devil, which is based on the Russian novel Master and Margarita. And that was written by Mikhail Bulgakov, who unfortunately was a Ukrainian, but always identified himself as a Russian, rather like Leon Trotsky, who was also Ukrainian, but identified himself as Russian. Bulgakov wrote this wonderful book, and if you haven't read it, it certainly is one of the best books of the 20th century. A Russian, Mikhail Lokshin, living in the States, has done this wonderful film of this book. And the book includes Jesus of Nazareth, Pontius Pilate, Stalin, the whole system. And it takes a snook at Russian power. The only thing that can negate the negative of Russian power is the devil himself. But that's a good force, he would argue. And Lokshin made this film, the Ukraine invasion happened, and Hollywood withdrew the money. The only country in the world you can see this film at the moment, irony of ironies, is Russia. And Russians don't see the irony. They don't see it, that he's poking fun now at the Putin administration. We won't show it because Bulgakov was not a Ukrainian nationalist. And it seems another example of we all lose over some political showboating. Okay, so I said I'd end on a positive, and my feeling is that cultural exchange. I've been so many times, I've been with theatres from Ireland, Scotland and England to the Soviet Union. I've been with art tours, I've been with sports teams, and at the common level, there is a huge respect for British culture in Russia. And going round with Russians around the country, particularly the north, I have to say, the north of England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, a tremendous desire to learn more about the Russian people. It just seems somehow the London-based English intelligentsia or the powers that be just don't like Russia. And if you put people in charge who don't like Russia, and a wonderful example of this is Boris Johnson, who pretty much scuppered the peace talks in March 2022 by ensuring Zelensky that the West would support him until Putin was toppled. Typical, typical irresponsible and typical just not true. But the positive is that I think there's a thirst to get over this and somehow find a way through to talking again to ordinary Russian people, and through that, filtering up from the bottom up to make relations between the states a lot better. Because in 60 years, in 66 years now, they've never been worse, and that's not good for any of us. Thank you.